Hello, this is John Meadows, and welcome to a special bonus edition of the Classic Camera Revival Podcast.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
As a process, the daguerreotype dates from the very dawn of photography in the 1830s. Supposedly made obsolete in the mid-19th century by the wet plate process, it's never quite gone away. Practitioners have always been drawn to its peculiar, exquisite beauty. There's just something about holding a daguerreotype in your hands that make it special and magical in a way that is unique to that process. Even in the 21st century, there are practitioners who are dedicated to keeping the daguerreotype alive, and one of the most preeminent practitioners is Toronto's own Mike Robinson. I was privileged to have the chance to speak with him recently. Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to be on our show.
Oh, my pleasure, John.
Now, Mike, you are one of the preeminent daguerreotype artists, probably the highest profile in Canada and in a very select company worldwide. And my understanding is that when you started your career in photography, you started off using like traditional, I guess we'd call mainstream black and white film, and you almost sort of worked your way backwards in time using older and older classical processes until you got to daguerreotype. And what was it about daguerreotype that made you settle on that process?
Well, I'll start back with the large format work I was working with. I was working with an 8x10-inch view camera, making contact prints from large format negatives. I was very interested and passionate about the ultimate in photographic quality of the medium I was dealing with. I rarely shot 35mm film. When I got interested in 19th century photography was when I saw an exhibition of Aceh's albumen prints. And I was seeing qualities in those 100-year-old photographs that I was not getting with modern materials. And so I had taught myself the albumen printing process while I was a student at Ryerson. And from there, I got involved teaching workshops in albumen printing at the George Eastman House Museum, where I met people that were teaching wet collodion and eventually daguerreotype. So as I got involved with those people and continued to teach historic processes at Ryerson, I worked with collodion for 2 or 3 years. But once you see a daguerreotype, even to this day, it is unequaled in its ability to render tone and quality and resolution. It's just unmatched even with the finest cameras of today.
And my understanding is that the daguerreotype process, unlike regular film that has grain structure, the daguerreotypes are basically grainless?
Pretty much. You have to imagine that the halides are formed on an atomic level. It's pure silver and pure iodine and bromine vapor. With film emulsions, the halides are formed in a crystal grain, which are quite a bit larger than the halides in a daguerreotype. And so once the latent image is formed in the daguerreotype, the image particles are formed right at that site. So it is significantly finer grained.
Now, one thing about the daguerreotype process, certainly the traditional version, is that it is not without some hazards. You know, the bromine is not particularly a nice substance, and I believe also that the mercury vapor used to develop the plates, of course, it's mercury. It's very dangerous, and I know that there is a somewhat safer process that some people use, but have you still focused on the traditional process?
Yes, I work exclusively with the traditional process. The safer process you're talking about isn't new. It was figured out in 1841 by Becquerel. And basically, it doesn't use mercury, it doesn't use bromine. It's an iodized silver plate, which requires more exposure than a mercury-developed plate. But after exposure, it's then printed out like you would print out a salted paper print under a red filter. And the image forms over sometimes several hours of exposure to red light. Now, the quality of a Becquerel plate rarely can hold a candle to traditionally processed plates. And they do work slower than plates prepared with iodine and bromine and mercury.
And what precautions do you take to avoid the chemistry?
Well, I have a fully operating fume hood and lab, and my development mercury box is designed not to release any vapors. And that's usually the first comment people say, oh, you must be crazy to be dealing with such dangerous chemicals. Well, you know, every chemical can be dangerous if it's not controlled. Just to give you an example, the mercury bath in my fume hood, my mercury bath holds 20 milliliters of mercury. And I put that in the mercury bath in 1998, and after thousands and thousands of daguerreotypes, there's still pretty close to 20 milliliters of mercury in the bath. So very, very little mercury is actually consumed in the process.
Now, I guess in the 19th century, people were a bit more rough and ready. And I believe there were cases of photographers or darkroom technicians developing illness consistent with mercury exposure. I guess people just weren't as careful back then.
Oh, absolutely. Some, you know, there were daguerreans that were cautious. Claudet in London had an operating fume hood. You know, it wasn't run by electricity, but it was run by a standard vent blowing across a pipe. So many photographers did take care to vent their mercury. There were mercury baths designed not to release, but of course there were always those that didn't heed that advice and did get ill. And there's a few examples of daguerreans, but they weren't. There wasn't a major worldwide illness, mercury illness, for photographers.
Now, I wanted to talk a bit about the equipment you use. Like, are you basically shooting up half plate, quarter plate size?
Yeah, I use the traditional sizes. I'm not sure why I chose to use the traditional size. Well, I do know why. I do have three original daguerreotype cameras that I use. I also have replica cameras that I use. My largest size that I normally do is half plate, which is 4.25 by 5.5 inch. I have done full plate. The reason I work with half plate is because I use silver clad plates made as they were made in the 19th century. And so I'm able to get an image quality that is equal to the fine work of the 19th century. Many other daguerreans use electroplated materials. It's a different silver, has different hardness, it's a different microstructure, has a different look to the plate.
And what lenses do you like to use?
I have a whole gamut of lenses. My favorites are the Petzl design, the Voigtlander lenses. Voigtlander, I'm sure you may know, is the marketer of the first portrait lens design for photography. It's fast working, which is necessary. They're roughly f3.3 to 3.5-ish range. I have one lens that I really love to use. It's actually one of my favorites in my collection. It's a Holmes, Booth & Hayden Petzl lens, but it was used by a Toronto amprotypist, John G. Turner. And engraved inside the lens barrel is the name J.G. Turner, Toronto, March 17, 1859.
Oh, that's neat.
It's really quite lovely to be able to still make ambrotypes and daguerreotypes with a lens that was used in Toronto back when it was new.
Do you work with any modern lenses, or do you stick with the classic lenses?
No, I use, depending on what I'm shooting. I have a wonderful Zenitar 150 f/2.8, which I love for its speed and its flatness of field. So the one thing about the Petzl lens is that it has a very unique signature, a curved focus field. This is lovely for single headshots, if you will, but when you start getting groups of people, it becomes much more of a challenge to get everyone into focus. And so I may then choose to use a modern, fast-working lens.
I have a Petzval lens, I think the Frederick J. Cox, the English lens, from, I guess, it's from the 1860s. I found the same thing. It's great for taking picture of one person, but even I was trying to do a picture of two people, and I was just pulling my hair out.
Yeah,
it's meant for single people.
So the fast working lenses have become astronomically expensive with the resurgence of handmade photographic processes. When I was collecting and buying my Petzval lenses, 15 years ago, I was paying $100 to $300 for it, but now they seem to have gone up tenfold in price. So people that are starting to get into these antique processes now that want a fast-working lens, they end up having to pay exorbitant prices to acquire a Petzval.
Yeah, I don't think my lens is the greatest, but I'm very glad I bought it when I did, which is about four years ago.
As you may know, the daguerreotype is reversed left to right, and mm-hmm. so I often do views with a reversing prism on the front of the lens to correct lateral inversion. So many of my landscape lenses, the mirror works best on a landscape lens, which is a smaller lens. So I have 19th century French Achromats, which were designed the same design as Daguerre used. And they were popular right through until the rapid rectilinear was invented. That's a very popular lens because the mirror for reversing fits it well.
That's a fairly small aperture lens.
Yeah, its widest working aperture is about f16.
So focusing must be, unless you shoot on infinity, focusing must be a bit of a challenge, must be rather dim under the cloth.
Well, don't forget, it's for working outside. Mm-hmm. So it's usually not so bad working at f16 focusing. What's really fun trying to focus and frame is when you have a mirror on the front of the lens, because it becomes, it's almost like the same effect you get when you're trying to shoot with a waist-level viewfinder in a medium format when you rotate to frame the scene. You have to work backwards. Mm-hmm. But when you have reversing prism as well, when that rotates around the barrel of the lens, you get the horizontal shift is a real challenge to try and work with convergence and keeping the horizon straight.
When you're shooting, let's say, indoors, I think one of your online videos, you were at the Smithsonian, I believe?
Yeah.
What's your typical exposure? Like I saw you had the head clamp.
Oh, yeah, that's fairly necessary, having a headrest. It's not a clamp, really. You don't really clamp the head. It's called a rest, and I have five of them here in the studio, an original Jenny Lind-style headrest. But I have a North Light studio, so I have fairly good light and typical exposure times in May, which is probably the most actinic light of the season. I can expose plates in anywhere from 2 to 10 seconds. The Smithsonian was a longer exposure because I had a very narrow window in the library room, and so I think the exposure time is about a minute in that situation.
And the subject was able to sit reasonably still?
She did well. I think there was two or three different shots I did, so I'm not sure which movie you saw, but yeah, it was fine. I mean, the headrest works really well. The point is that you keep your eyes fixed on a point. And blinking is not at all a problem because that's a very short, millisecond compared to the overall exposure. So you can have a relaxed face and you can blink at your without any difficulty. So when you hear in movies where they say don't blink, well, that really doesn't.
You can't help it. Now, it must be a really special reaction when someone that you've made a portrait of, when you show them the daguerreotype, they really must be amazed at what they see.
Yes, it's quite different than looking at your image on your iPhone or getting your prints back from the one-hour lab. The daguerreotype, because of the length of time, it changes your countenance. I often have to encourage my sitters to smile with their eyes and to really take on a pleasing expression, because that length of time tends to add not so much a scowl, but a very serious look to the sitter's face. And you know, they often look at their image like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize I was so serious. One of the other challenges, of course, is the process is predominantly sensitive to ultraviolet and blue light. And so people with reddish complexions or freckles, those are exaggerated in the process. So you have to understand that could happen, and you have to account for it. You have to give additional exposure for the person's complexion. There's other tricks of the trade that you can use to brighten up the less actinic colors, and preparing the plate the way you sensitize it. You have to sensitize your plate for the different types of contrast you're working with.
And so is it a question of proportions or length of the bromine versus iodine or length of sensitization time, or how do you, I wasn't aware that degree of control was available.
It's infinite control, but it will confound you infinitely too. It's extremely challenging to get the precise balance. If you're off 5% either way, you can end up with a blank plate. Yeah, so you really have to know what you're doing. As you sensitize the plate, when the iodine coating is formed on the plate changes color. It goes through the rainbow, and that is an indication of how much silver iodide you're putting on the plate. Well, some of those colors work extremely fast, and some of those colors don't work at all. So it's a very, very complicated art in sensitizing the plate so that the color of the sensitized coating you present to the scene is at the optimum of speed, which is fine for, for example, if I'm shooting in a Northlight studio, the contrast is low, I'll want to present a magenta coating to the subject. Whereas if I'm working on a bright day outside where it's a longer scale day, I'll slow down the plate. I'll have a blue coating on the plate, which absorbs less blue light and slows down the blue light and allows for more time to expose for the greens. So it's always a juggling act with every subject. It's not like film. Film is or collodion, for that matter. And they have a fixed working contrast, and you get to know that. Whereas with the daguerreotype, it's infinite.
And I guess these are like the subtle technical skills and details that the finest daguerreotypists of the 19th century would have known.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I can, if you know the zone system at all, I can record 10 zone range on a plate.
Wow.
13 stop range I've recorded, detail and highlights and shadows. So it's really, that's one of the beauties, that's one of the challenges and one of the beauties I love about the process. It's really tunable, if you will.
And the thrill must be there every time you develop a plate. I would hope it never gets old.
Oh, it never gets old, no. But there's always, the biggest challenge, of course, is when you do a portrait session. You know, when I have someone come for a portrait, I tell them that, expect to work with me for 2 or 3 hours. Because the first plate will really, the other thing is that the chemicals also change from day to day. So what may have been a 25-second bromine coating, which worked well on Tuesday, may not work at all on Thursday. So you constantly have to be testing your chemicals for just the right coating. So usually the first plate in a sitting is it's rare that it's the winner. It's usually the one that tells me where I have to go next, where I have to adjust the sensitizing to suit that particular subject or suit the chemicals of that day.
And roughly how long does it take to process the plate after exposure?
Not long. Mercury development times, that's also a variable you can control. You can develop in for 3 minutes or you can develop for 10 minutes, depending on what you're looking for. But, you know, in that range would be the development time. It's fixed with sodium thiosulfate in a minute, and then it's toned with gold chloride. And the toning process can take another 4 to 6 minutes, depending on the plate size.
And the gold chloride, part of the process is just to give a bit of stability, because I know that the daguerreotype is such an incredibly delicate image.
Yes, you've done your research. The original process of 1839... introduced by Daguerre, used iodine, no bromine, which was 60 times slower than when they introduced bromine as an accelerant. So imagine minutes to seconds.
Wow.
It's as the speed gain when you have the multiply sensitized plates. But Daguerre's exposure on an F-16 lens on a nice day in September would have been 15 minutes outside. So the plates developed after exposure with mercury vapor, and then it was fixed with salt water or sodium thiosulfate, and then sealed behind glass. And in that state, the silver-mercury amalgam image particles on the polished plate were described as like the dust on a butterfly's wing. It could be simply wiped, it can be simply wiped off with a feather. The gold toning process, what it does, it creates a gold-silver amalgam, not only on the image particles, but also on the plate itself. And then also it forms underneath the image particles, acts sort of like a glue to firmly bond the image particles to the plate surface. And so the surface gets more reflective with the gold coating, so the blacks are improved in the image, and the image particles themselves get larger, so they scatter light more efficiently, and so the whites get brighter. So contrast and stability is improved with gold toning.
And it also allows, you can apply some color toning if you want to do that.
Yeah, absolutely, because the colorants are a very fine powdered pigment, which are basically stippled on very carefully with a brush, and you blow off the excess. And then when you want to set the color on the plate, you would, because they're ground with gum arabic, you would just breathe on the plate, and the moisture from your breath would be enough to adhere the plate.
Such delicacy over the entire process.
Yeah.
It's not the process for people who are slapdash in their technique.
Yeah. No. It's the process is not to be taken lightly. You need to be working with the process frequently for regular success. It's very easy to fail. You know, I think in the 19th century, the Daguerreans wrote, you know, if you don't have the courage to fail 500 times before success, don't get into the game.
That's a great quote, and I think that could be like the pull quote of the interview. I think
I can't remember quite who said it. It might have been Claude, but I'll have to look that up and get back to you on who and what the precise words are. But it was something along that effect.
So, Mike, of course, you know, we were talking a bit about colorizing or applying pigment to daguerreotype, which sort of assumes that the base daguerreotype is basically, you know, strictly black and white. But I understand that that's sort of a limiting way of looking at this. Actually, there is some tonal variation in color.
Oh, absolutely. And plates between different makers all have different color signatures, if you will. The term they used in the 19th century was called a prismatic effect. So you have to understand that a daguerreotype, unlike any other photograph, the image is formed by scattered light. And how the image particles are formed on the plate affect how the light is scattered. So I've made daguerreotypes that that when you hold it in your hand, it'll look completely wonderfully warm magenta pink in value. And then as you tilt it slightly in your hand, it'll flip to a cyan green look. It has this beautiful prismatic flipping effect. The other thing about it is overexposed areas, where such as the sky, actually, because the particles are so small, scatter light and appear blue. So you actually get blue skies in daguerreotypes without any hand coloring.
Wow.
Which is another beautiful aesthetic tool that I often use when I'm considering how to shoot my daguerreotype. Do I want to have any blue in a highly exposed area, or do I want to keep it as white? So that's another challenge for daguerreotypists. Yeah.
And again, to see the full effect, you have to be in the room like with the daguerreotype in your hands.
You have to see the plate in hand. There's really no substitute. They can reproduce. You can scan them very easily. You can photograph them very easily. But you do not get that prismatic effect or that wonderful effect when the plate's held in hand and turned against the light this way and that way.
So, Mike, I have two more questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
You're based in Toronto. As am I. And so the question is that this is of interest more to our Canadian listeners. How do you get the materials in Canada?
Oh, well, I have my plates are made special for me by a company in Long Island, New York. And I've been working with them for 15 years, and I'm actually the distributor for daguerreotype plates of this design, of clad metal plates. So I sell them worldwide.
Okay, that's good to know.
To daguerreans who use it. Now, the equipment is designed and built. I designed the equipment and built some of it. My brother-in-law, who no longer is with us, he designed and built the mercury baths and the sensitizing boxes. So that, you know, any equipment you need to make daguerreotypes has to be fabricated by hand anyway. So a good machinist, a good carpenter, if you have the skills yourself. There are a few people now making sensitizing boxes and mercury boxes, if you want. They're online. There's an organization called ContemporaryDaguerreotypes.org or CDAGS.org. You'll find resources there for materials. Luckily for chemicals, I'm just within walking distance from me is a great company I've been dealing with for years. It's called Nymoc, and they sell chemicals to photographers, but to virtually any trade that requires chemicals. They also make wonderful custom-made soap, you know, the soap works. So I've really been lucky being able to get iodine and bromine and mercury when I needed it.
So it is eminently possible in Canada to get what you need to do this process.
It is absolutely possible to get what you need. What you need more than anything is, I would recommend, is training, a workshop. So I got my training by reading 19th century manuals. I took an introductory workshop. What you will learn from taking a workshop, and my next one I'm teaching is in New York City next month, and I teach them at Laycock Abbey in the UK every year. What you will learn from a workshop will save you years of trial and error. And so if you're serious enough to get into the daguerreotyping, which is not inexpensive to get into, if you're serious enough to invest in the equipment, you will do yourself a world of good to take a lesson or two at a workshop.
And that sort of segues into my last question, which is about the teaching and the training. Is there such a thing as a typical student, or what that you work with, or what in your mind draws people to the process?
Well, I think what draws people to the process is what draws collectors or any, you know, the daguerreotypes are really magical things. If you've had a chance to hold them in your hand, you will know when you see an extremely fine daguerreotype that you've got something special in your hand. And so I get historians that come to experience having sit for a daguerreotype, so and see it made. So And I have teachers that come so that they can better explain to their class on how the world's first photographic, practical photographic process worked. I have, you know, of every 100 students I teach, I would estimate probably one or two only continue on to make daguerreotypes.
But even if people don't, I guess, they don't all do it, they still leave with an appreciation.
Absolutely.
And a better understanding.
A phenomenal understanding. Because it really, it looks easy when you see it done, where it's basically you do this, you do this, you do this, and in less than, you know, 20 minutes, you're holding an image in your hand, finished and ready to go. I mean, how can that not seem easy? And they're really quite magical. But
it's like playing the violin is easy. You just pull the bow across the strings with one hand and move your strings up and down the neck with your other.
Yeah. But you have to realize there are thousands and thousands of hours that went into the knowledge to know how to read the process.
And from a demographic point of view, are there young people showing interest in the process?
Oh, yes. I have, I wouldn't even put a single age group. I have students that I teach are in their 20s that are become fascinated with it. What's really interesting, you know, I've been teaching, for almost 20 years now at Ryerson, and I've noticed in the last 5 years that I now have students that have never actually shot a roll film. Or have never used a camera that had controls that they understood, such as apertures and shutter speeds. So I've had to recalibrate my entire way of teaching with students that really, I used to assume they had a basic understanding on how light is controlled with a camera. But now that even that is hard for some students to grasp, and they've never been in a dark room, they never used an enlarger. They never worked in a wet lab. So these students that, you know, when they see that you can actually make something completely with your own hands, it's very powerful for them.
Yeah, and I think, especially for daguerreotype, I think also like for film photography in general, you know, certainly on our show, we're all passionately dedicated to the idea of keeping film photography alive in face of the digital onslaught, is just the magic of having it in your hands and having it being real.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the reasons I do this, people say, why do you love the daguerreotype? And I said, well, you know, any photograph that is made today with a digital camera, we don't know what its lifespan is going to be. It could be as short as months, depending on the material that it's stored on. But I can tell you, a daguerreotype will outlast your great 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 grandkids. You know, these are very very permanent objects, more permanent than most 20th century photos. And so, that's the other thing. You know, in being a historian, to leave a legacy, I think there's no finer object than to leave your photographic legacy on a daguerreotype plate.
Well, Mike, I think that is a good place to stop. So once again, thank you so much for taking the time to be on our show. It's most appreciated.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. It's been nice to meet you on the phone. Hopefully we'll meet together in the flesh someday.
Before I go, a reminder of our event on Saturday, May 7th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Hamilton, Ontario, the Classic Camera Revival Gas Meetup. Fans and friends of the Classic Camera Revival podcast can have a chance to meet each other and the host of the show. There will be plenty of time to drool over each other's cameras and gear. Plus, this is Hamilton's Doors Open weekend, so there will be plenty to shoot as the hosts lead a couple of photo walks through the downtown. We'll be meeting at 10 a.m. at Ferguson Station Park, King Street East, and Ferguson Street South. There's plenty of cheap parking throughout the downtown. There'll be more details in our podcast and on classiccamerarevival.com, as well as the Toronto Film Shooters Group on Facebook. You can also send me an email, jgmeadows@gmail.com, and I'll make sure that you're kept in the loop for our first meetup. We hope to see you there.